A small crystal shard bridled a reserve of incredible power, but without a wielder, it was akin to a sheathed sword with no hand to draw it. Thus, Crenshinabon exerted its will through manipulation, insinuating illusions of conquest into the wizard's dreams, allowing Kessel to view the possibilities of power. It dangled a carrot before the nose of the once bumbling apprentice that he could not refuse. Respect. Kessel, ever a spitbucket for the pretentious wizards in Luskan, and everyone else it seemed, was easy prey for such ambitions. He, who had been down in the dirt beside the boots of the important people, ached for the chance to reverse the roles. And now, he had the opportunity to turn his fantasies into reality, Crenshinabon often assured him. With the relic close to his heart, he could become the conqueror. He could make people, even the wizards in the host tower, tremble at the mere mention of his name. He had to remain patient. He had spent several years learning the subtleties of controlling one and then a second goblin tribe. Yet the task of bringing together dozens of tribes and bending their natural enmity into a common cause of servitude to him was far more challenging. He had to bring them in, one at a time at first, and ensure that he had enslaved them to his will wholeheartedly before he dared summon another group. But it was working, and now he had brought in two rival tribes simultaneously with positive results. Torga and Grok had entered Kryshel Tirith, each searching for a way to kill the other without bringing on the wrath of the wizard. When they left, though, after a short discussion with Kessel, they were chatting like old friends about the glory of their coming battles in the army of Akkar Kessel. Kessel lounged back on his pillows and considered his good fortune. His army was indeed taking shape. He had frost giants for his field commanders, ogres as his field guard, Verbeeg as a deadly strike force, and trolls, wretched, fear-inspiring trolls, as his personal bodyguard. And by his count thus far, 10,000 fanatically loyal goblin kin troops to carry out his swath of destruction. "Akkar Kessel!" he shouted to the harem girl that manicured his long fingernails as he sat in contemplation, though the girl's mind had long ago been destroyed by Crenshinabon. "All glory to the tyrant of Icewind Dale!" Far to the south of the frozen steppes, in the civilized lands where men had more time for leisure activities and contemplation, and every action wasn't determined by sheer necessity, wizards and would-be wizards were less rare. The true mages, lifelong students of the arcane arts, practiced their trade with due respect for the magic, ever wary of the potential consequences of their spellcastings. Unless consumed by the lust for power, which was a very dangerous thing, the true mages tempered their experiments with caution and rarely caused disasters. The would-be mages, however, men who somehow had come into a degree of magical prowess, whether they had found a scroll or a master spellbook or some relic, were often the perpetrators of colossal calamities. Such was the case that night, in a land 1,000 miles from Akkar Kessel and Crenshinabon. A wizard's apprentice, a young man who had shown great promise to his master, came into possession of a diagram of a powerful magic circle, and then sought and found a spell of summoning. The apprentice, lured by the promise of power, managed to extract the true name of a demon from his master's private notes. Sorcery, the art of summoning entities from other planes into servitude, was this young man's particular love. His master had allowed him to bring midges and manes through a magical portal, closely supervised, hoping to demonstrate the potential dangers of the practice and reinforce the lessons of caution. Actually, the demonstrations had only served to heighten the young man's appetite for the art. He had begged his master to allow him to try for a true demon, but the wizard knew that he wasn't ready for such a test. The apprentice disagreed. He had completed inscribing the circle that same day. So confident was he in his work that he didn't spend an extra day, Some wizards would spend a 10-day checking the runes and symbols, or bother to test the circle on a lesser entity, such as a main. And now he sat within it, his eyes focused on the fire of the brazier that would serve as the gate to the abyss. With a self-assured, overly proud smile, the would-be sorcerer called the demon. Ertu, a major demon of catastrophic proportions, faintly heard its name being uttered on the faraway plain. Normally, the great beast would have ignored such a weak call. Certainly the summoner hadn't demonstrated any ability of sufficient strength to compel the demon to comply. Yet Ertu was glad of the fateful call. A few years before, the demon had felt a surge of power on the material plane that it believed would culminate a quest it had undertaken a millennium ago. The demon had suffered through the last few years impatiently, eager for a wizard to open a path for it so that it could come to the material plane and investigate. The young apprentice felt himself being drawn into the hypnotic dance of the brazier's fire. The blaze had unified into a single flame, like the burn of a candle, only many times larger, and it swayed tantalizingly back and forth, back and forth. The mesmerized apprentice wasn't even aware of the growing intensity of the fire. The flame leaped higher and higher, its flickering sped up, and its color moved through the spectrum toward the ultimate heat of whiteness. Back and forth, back and forth. Faster now, wagging wildly, and building its strength to support the mighty entity that waited on the other side. Back and forth, back and forth. The apprentice was sweating. He knew that the power of the spell was growing beyond his bounds, that the magic had taken over and was living a life of its own, that he was powerless to stop it. Back and forth, back and forth. Now he saw the dark shadow within the flame, the great clawed hands, and the leathery, bat-like wings, and the size of the beast, a giant even by the standards of its kind. "Ertu!" the young man called, the words forced from him by the demands of the spell. The name hadn't been completely identified in his master's notes, but he saw clearly that it belonged to a mighty demon, a monster ranking just below the demon lords in the hierarchy of the abyss. Back and forth, back and forth. Now the grotesque monkey-like head, with the maw and muzzle of a dog and the oversized incisors of a boar, was visible, the huge blood-red eyes squinting from within the brazier's flame. The acidic drool sizzled as it fell to the fire. Back and forth, back and forth. The fire surged into a final climax of power, and Ertu stepped through. The demon didn't pause at all to consider the terrified young human that had foolishly called its name. It began a slow stalk around the magic circle in search of clues to the extent of this wizard's power. The apprentice finally managed to steady himself. He had summoned a major demon. That fact helped him to re-establish his confidence in his abilities as a sorcerer. "Stand before me," he commanded, aware that a firm hand was necessary to control a creature from the chaotic lower planes. Ertu, undisturbed, continued its stalk. The apprentice grew angry. "You will obey me," he screamed. "I brought you here, and I hold the key to your torment. You shall obey my command, and then I shall release you, mercifully, back to your own filthy world. Now stand before me." The apprentice was defiant. The apprentice was proud. But Ertu had found an error in the tracing of a rune, a fatal imperfection in a magic circle that could not afford to be almost perfect. The apprentice was dead. Ertu felt the familiar sensation of power more distinctly on the material plane, and had little trouble discerning the direction of the emanations. It soared on its great wings over the cities of the humans, spreading a panic wherever it was noticed, but not delaying its journey to savor the erupting chaos below. Arrows straight and with all speed, Ertu soared over lakes and mountains, across great expanses of empty land, toward the northernmost range in the realms, the spine of the world. and the ancient relic that it had spent centuries searching for. Kessel was aware of the approaching demon long before his assembled troops began scattering in terror from under the swooping shadow of darkness. Crenshinabon had imparted the information to the wizard, the living relic anticipating the movements of the powerful creature from the lower planes that had been pursuing it for ages uncounted. Kessel wasn't worried, though. Inside his tower of strength, he was confident that he could handle even a nemesis as mighty as Ertu. And he had a distinct advantage over the demon. He was the rightful wielder of the relic. It was attuned to him, and like so many other magical artifacts from the dawn of the world, Crenshinabon could not be wrested from its possessor by sheer force. Ertu desired to wield the relic, and therefore would not dare to oppose Kessel and invoke Crenshinabon's wrath. Acid drool slipped freely from the demon's mouth when it saw the tower image of the relic.
"How many years?" it bellowed victoriously.
Ertu saw the tower's door clearly, for the demon was a creature not of the material plane, and approached it once. None of Kessel's goblins or even giants stood to hinder the demon's entrance. Flanked by his trolls, the wizard was waiting for Ertu in Kryshal Tirith's main chamber, the tower's first level. The wizard understood that the trolls would be of little use against a fire-wielding demon, but he wanted them present to enhance the demon's first impression of him. He knew that he held the power to send Ertu away easily enough, but another thought, again implanted through a suggestion of the crystal shard, had come to him. The demon could be very useful. Ertu pulled up short when it passed through the narrow entryway and came upon the wizard's entourage. Because of the remote location of the tower, the demon had expected to find an orc, or perhaps a giant holding the shard. It had hoped to intimidate and trick the slow-witted wielder into surrendering the relic. But the sight of a robed human, probably even a mage, threw a snag into its plans.
"Greetings, mighty demon," Kessel said politely, bowing low. "Welcome to my humble home."
Ertu growled in rage and started forward, forgetting the drawbacks of destroying the possessor in its all-consuming hatred and envy for the smug human. Crenshinabon reminded the demon. A sudden flare of light pulsed from the tower walls, engulfing Ertu in the painful brightness of a dozen desert suns. The demon halted and covered its sensitive eyes. The light dissipated soon enough, but Ertu held its ground and did not approach the wizard again. Kessel smirked. The relic had supported him. Brimming with confidence, he addressed the demon again, this time a stern edge in his voice.
"You have come to take this," he said,
reaching within the folds of his robe to produce the shard. Ertu's eyes narrowed and locked onto the object it had pursued for so long.
"You cannot have it,"
Kessel said flatly, and he replaced it under his robe.
"It is mine, rightfully found, and you have no claim over it that it would honor."
Kessel's foolish pride, the fatal flaw in his personality that had always pushed him down a road of certain tragedy, wanted him to continue his taunting of the demon in its helpless situation.
"Enough,"
warned a sensation within him. The silent voice he had come to suspect was the sentient will of the shard.
"This is none of your affair,"
Kessel shot back aloud. Ertu looked around the room, wondering who the wizard was addressing. Certainly the trolls had paid him no heed. As a precaution, the demon invoked various detection spells, fearing an unseen assailant.
"You taunt the dangerous foe," the shard persisted. "I have protected you from the demon, yet you persist in alienating a creature that would prove a valuable ally."
As was usually the case when Crenshinabon communicated with the wizard, Kessel began to see the possibilities. He decided upon a course of compromise, an agreement mutually beneficial to both himself and the demon. Ertu considered its predicament. It couldn't slay the impertinent human, though the demon would have truly savored such an act.
yet leaving without the relic, putting off the quest that had been its primary motivation for centuries, was not an acceptable option.
"I have a proposal to offer, a bargain that might interest you," Kessel said temptingly, avoiding the death-promising glare that the demon was throwing him. "Stay by my side and serve as commander of my forces. With you leading them and the power of Crenshinabon and Akkar Kessel behind them, they shall sweep through the Northland."
"Serve you?" Ertu laughed. "You have no hold over me, human."
"You view the situation incorrectly," retorted Kessel. "Think of it not as servitude, but as an opportunity to join in a campaign that promises destruction and conquest. You have my utmost respect, mighty demon. I would not presume to call myself your master."
Crenshinabon, with its subconscious intrusions, had coached Kessel well. Ertu's less threatening stance showed that it was intrigued by the wizard's proposition.
"And consider the gains that you shall someday make," Kessel continued. "Humans do not live a very long time by your ageless estimations. Who then shall take the crystal shard when Akkar Kessel is no more?"
Ertu smiled wickedly and bowed before the wizard.
"How could I refuse such a generous offer?"
the demon rasped in its horrible, unearthly voice.
"Show me, wizard, what glorious conquests lie in our path."
Kessel nearly danced with joy. His army was, in effect, complete. He had his general. 11. Aegis Fang. Sweat beaded on Brunner's hand as he put the key into the dusty lock of the heavy wooden door. This was the beginning of the process that would put all of his skill and experience to the ultimate trial. Like all master dwarven smiths, he had been waiting for this moment with excitement and apprehension since the beginning of his long training. He had to push hard to swing the door in on the small chamber. Its wood creaked and groaned in protest, having warped and settled since it was last opened many years before. This was a comfort to Brunner, though, for he dreaded the thought of anyone looking in on his most prized possessions. He glanced around at the dark corridors of this little-used section of the dwarven complex, making sure once more that he hadn't been followed. Then he entered the room, putting his torch in before him to burn away the hanging fringes of many cobwebs. The only piece of furniture in the room was a wooden, iron-bound box, banded by two heavy chains joined by a huge padlock. Spiderwebs crisscrossed and flowed from every angle of the chest, and a thick layer of dust covered its top. Another good sign, Brunner noted. He looked out into the hall again, then shut the wooden door as quietly as he could. He knelt before the chest and placed his torch on the floor beside him. Several webs, licked by its flame, puffed into orange for just an instant, then died away. Brunner took a small block of wood from his belt pouch and removed a silver key that hung on a chain about his neck. He held the wood block firmly in front of him and, keeping the fingers of his other hand below the level of the padlock as much as possible, gently slid the key into the lock. Now came the delicate part. Brunner turned the key slowly, listening. When he heard the tumbler in the lock click, he braced himself and quickly pulled his hand from the key, allowing the mass of the padlock to drop away from its ring, releasing a spring-loaded lever that had been pressed between it and the chest. The small dart knocked into the block of wood, and Brunner breathed a sigh of relief. Though he had set the trap nearly a century before, he knew that the poison of the tundra widowmaker snake had kept its deadly sting. Sheer excitement overwhelmed Brunner's reverence of this moment, and he hurriedly threw the chains back over the chest and blew the dust from its lid. He grasped the lid and started to lift it, but suddenly slowed again, recovering his solemn calm and reminding himself of the importance of every action. Anyone who had come upon this chest and managed to get by the deadly trap would have been pleased with the treasures he found inside. A silver goblet, a bag of gold, and a jeweled, though poorly balanced dagger were mixed in among other more personal and less valuable items. A dented helm, old boots, and other similar pieces that would hold little appeal for a thief. Yet these items were merely a foil. Brunner pulled them out and dropped them on the dirty floor without a second thought. The bottom of the heavy chest sat just above the level of the floor, giving no indication that anything more was to be found here. But Brunner had cunningly cut the floor lower under the chest, fitting the box into a hole so perfectly that even a scrutinizing thief would swear that it sat on the floor. The dwarf poked out a small knothole in the box's bottom and hooked a stubby finger through the opening. This wood, too, had settled over the years, and Brunner had to tug mightily to finally pull it free. It came out with a sudden snap, sending Brunner tumbling backward. He was back at the chest in an instant, peering cautiously over its edge at his greatest treasures. A block of the purest mithril, a small leather bag, a golden coffer, and a silver scroll tube capped on one end by a diamond were spaced exactly as Brunner had laid them so long ago. Brunner's hands trembled, and he had to stop and wipe the perspiration from them several times as he removed the precious items from the chest, placing those that would fit in his pack and laying the mithril block on a blanket he had unrolled. Then he quickly replaced the false bottom, taking care to fit the knothole back into the wood perfectly, and put his phony treasures back in place. He chained and locked the box, leaving everything exactly as he had found it, except that he saw no reason to chance accidents by rearming the needle trap. Brunner had constructed his outdoor forge in a hidden nook tucked away at the base of Kelvin's cairn. This was a seldom-traveled portion of the Dwarven Valley, the northern end, with Bremen's Run widening out into the open tundra around the western side of the mountain, and Icewind Pass doing likewise on the east. To his surprise, Brunner found that the stone here was hard and pure, deeply imbued with the strength of the earth, and would serve his small temple well. As always, Brunner approached this sacred place with measured, reverent steps. Carrying now the treasures of his heritage, his mind drifted back over the centuries to Mithril Hall, ancient home of his people, and to the speech his father had given him on the day he received his first smithy hammer.
"If your talent for the craft is keen," his father had said, "and you're lucky enough to live long and feel the strength of the earth, you'll find a special day. A special blessing, some would say a curse, has been placed upon our people. For once, and only once, the very best of our smiths may craft a weapon of their choosing that outdoes any work they'd ever done. Be wary of that day, son, for you'll put a great deal of yourself into that weapon. You'll never match its perfection in your life again, and knowing this, you'll lose a lot of the craftsman's desire that drives the swing of your hammer. You may find an empty life after your day, but if you're good as your line says you'll be, you'll have a crafted weapon of legend that will live on long after your bones are dust."
Brunner's father, cut down in the coming of the darkness to Mithril Hall, hadn't lived long enough to find his special day, though if he had, several of the items that Brunner now carried would have been used by him. But the dwarf saw no disrespect in his taking the treasures as his own, for he knew that he would craft a weapon to make the spirit of his father proud. Brunner's day had come. The image of a two-headed hammer hidden within the block of mithril had come to Brunner in a dream earlier that 10 day. The dwarf had understood the sign at once and knew that he would have to move quickly to get everything ready for the night of power that was fast approaching. Already the moon was big and bright in the sky. It would reach its fullness on the night of the solstice, the gray time between the seasons when the air tingled with magic. The full moon would only enhance the enchantment of that night, and Brunner believed that he would capture a mighty spell indeed when he uttered the Dwyamer of Power. The dwarf had much work before him if he was to be prepared. His labor had begun with the construction of the small forge. That had been the easy part, and he went about it mechanically, trying to hold his thoughts to the task at hand and away from the disrupting anticipation of crafting the weapon. Now, the time he had waited for was upon him. He pulled the heavy block of mithril from his pack, feeling its pureness and strength. He had held similar blocks before and grew apprehensive for a moment. He stared into the silvery metal. For a long moment, it remained a squared block. Then its sides appeared to round as the image of the marvelous warhammer came clear to the dwarf. Brunner's heart raced, and he breathed in short gasps. His vision had been real. He fired up the forge and began his work at once, laboring through the night until the light of dawn dispelled the charm that was upon him. He returned to his home that day, only to collect the adamantite rod he had set aside for the weapon, returning to the forge to sleep, and later to pace nervously while he waited for darkness to fall. As soon as daylight faded, Brunner eagerly went back to work. The metal molded easily under his skilled manipulations, and he knew that before dawn could interrupt him, the head of the hammer would be formed. Though he still had hours of work ahead of him, Brunner felt a surge of pride at that moment. He knew that he would meet his demanding schedule. He would attach the adamantite handle the next night, and all would be ready for the enchantment under the full moon on the night of the summer solstice. The owl swooped silently down on the small rabbit, guided toward its prey by senses as acute as any living creature's. This would be a routine kill, with the unfortunate beast never even aware of the coming predator. Yet the owl was strangely agitated, and its hunter's concentration wavered at the last moment. Seldom did the great bird miss, but this time it flew back to its home on the side of Kelvin's cairn, without a meal. Far out on the tundra, a lone wolf sat as still as a statue, anxious but patient as the silver disk of the huge summer moon broke the flat rim of the horizon. It waited until the alluring orb came full in the sky, then it took up the ancient howling cry of its breed. It was answered again and again by distant wolves and other denizens of the night, all calling out to the power of the heavens. The night of the summer solstice, when magic tingled in the air, exciting all but the rational beings who had rejected such base instinctual urges, had begun. In his emotional state, Brunner felt the magic distinctly. But absorbed in the culmination of his life's labors, he had attained a level of calm concentration. His hands did not tremble as he opened the golden lid of the small coffer. The mighty warhammer lay clamped to the anvil before the dwarf. It represented Brunner's finest work, powerful and beautifully crafted even now, but waiting for the delicate runes and intonations that would make it a weapon of special power. Brunner reverently removed the small silver mallet and chisel from the coffer and approached the warhammer. Without hesitation, for he knew that he had little time for such intricate work, he set the chisel on the mithril and solidly tapped it with the mallet. The untainted metals sang out a clear, pure note that sent shivers through the appreciative dwarf's spine. He knew in his heart that all of the conditions were perfect, and he shivered again when he thought of the result of this night's labors. He did not see the dark eyes peering intently at him from a ridge a short distance away. Brunner needed no model for the first carvings. They were symbols etched into his heart and soul. Solemnly, he inscribed the hammer and anvil of Moradin the Soul Forger on the side of one of the warhammer's heads, and the crossed axes of Clangadin, the dwarven god of battle, across from the first on the side of the other head. Then he took the silver scroll tube and gently removed its diamond cap. He sighed in relief when he saw that the parchment inside had survived the decades. Wiping the oily sweat from his hands, he removed the scroll and slowly unrolled it, laying it on the flat of the anvil. At first, the page seemed blank, but gradually the rays of the full moon coaxed its symbols, the secret runes of power, to appear. These were Brunner's heritage, and though he had never seen them before, their arcane lines and curves seemed comfortably familiar to him. His hand steady with confidence, the dwarf placed the silver chisel between the symbols he had inscribed of the two gods, and began etching the secret runes onto the warhammer. He felt their magic transferring from the parchment through him to the weapon, and watched in amazement as each one disappeared from the scroll after he had inscribed it onto the mithril. Time had no meaning to him now, as he fell deeply into the trance of his work. But when he had completed the runes, he noticed that the moon had passed its peak and was on the wane. The first real test of the dwarf's expertise came when he overlaid the rune carvings with the gem inside the mountain symbol of Dumathoin, the keeper of secrets. The lines of the god symbol aligned perfectly with those of the runes, obscuring the secret tracings of power. Brunner knew then that his work was nearly complete. He removed the heavy warhammer from its clamp and took out the small leather bag. He had to take several deep breaths to steady himself, for this was the final and most decisive test of his skill. He loosened the cord at the top of the bag and marveled at the gentle shimmering of the diamond dust in the soft light of the moon. From behind the ridge, Drisdo Erden tensed in anticipation. But he was careful not to disturb his friend's complete concentration. Brunner steadied himself again, then suddenly snapped the bag into the air, releasing its contents high into the night. He tossed the bag aside, grasped the warhammer in both hands, and raised it above his head. The dwarf felt his very strength being sucked from him as he uttered the words of power, but he would not truly know how well he had performed until his work was complete. The level of perfection of his carvings determined the success of his intonations, for as he had etched the runes onto the weapon, their strength had flowed into his heart. This power then drew the magical dust to the weapon, and its power, in turn, could be measured by the amount of shimmering diamond dust it captured. A fit of blackness fell over the dwarf. His head spun, and he did not understand what kept him from toppling. But the consuming power of the words had gone beyond him. Though he wasn't even conscious of them, the words continued to flow from his lips in an undeniable stream, sapping more and more of his strength. Then, mercifully, he was falling, though the void of unconsciousness took him long before his head hit the ground. Drizzt turned away and slumped back against the rocky ridge. He, too, was exhausted from the spectacle. He didn't know if his friend would survive this night's ordeal, yet he was thrilled for Brunner. For he had witnessed the dwarf's most triumphant moment, even if Brunner had not, as the hammer's mithril head flared with a life of magic and pulled in the shower of diamond. And not a single speck of the glittering dust had escaped Brunner's beckon. 12. The Gift. Wulfgar sat high up on the northern face of Brunner's climb, his eyes trained on the expanse of the rocky valley below, intently seeking any movement that might indicate the dwarf's return. The barbarian came to this spot often to be alone with his thoughts and the mourn of the wind. Directly before him, across the dwarven vale, were Kelvin's Cairn and the northern section of Lac Dinashir. Between them lay the flat stretch of ground known as Icewind Pass that led to the northeast and the open plain. And for the barbarian, the pass that led to his homeland. Brunner had explained that he would be gone for a few days, and at first Wulfgar was happy for the relief from the dwarf's constant grumbling and criticism. But he found his relief short-lived.
"Worried for him, are you?" came a voice behind him.
He didn't have to turn to know that it was Catti Bree. He left the question unanswered, figuring that she had asked it rhetorically anyway and would not believe him if he denied it.
"He'll be back,"
Catti Bree said with a shrug in her voice.
"Brunner's as hard as mountain stone, and there is nothing on the tundra that can stop him."
Now the young barbarian did turn to consider the girl. Long ago, when a comfortable level of trust had been reached between Brunner and Wolfgar, the dwarf had introduced the young barbarian to his daughter, a human girl the barbarian's own age. She was an outwardly calm girl, but packed with an inner fire and spirit that Wolfgar had been unaccustomed to in a woman. Barbarian girls were raised to keep their thoughts and opinions, unimportant by the standards of men, to themselves. Like her mentor, Catti Bree said exactly what was on her mind and left little doubt as to how she felt about a situation. The verbal sparring between her and Wolfgar was nearly constant and often heated, but still, Wolfgar was glad to have a companion his own age, someone who didn't look down at him from a pedestal of experience. Catti Bree had helped him through the difficult first year of his indenture, treating him with respect, although she rarely agreed with him when he had none for himself. Wolfgar even had the feeling that she had something indirectly to do with Brunner's decision to take Wolfgar under his tutorship. She was his own age, but in many ways Catti Bree seemed much older, with a solid inner sense of reality that kept her temperament on an even level. In other ways, however, such as the skipping spring in her step, Catti Bree would forever be a child. This unusual balance of spirit and calm, of serenity and unbridled joy, intrigued Wolfgar and kept him off balance whenever he spoke with the girl. Of course, there were other emotions that put Wolfgar at a disadvantage when he was with Catti Bree. Undeniably, she was beautiful, with thick waves of rich auburn hair rolling down over her shoulders and the darkest blue, penetrating eyes that would make any suitor blush under their knowing scrutiny. Still, there was something beyond any physical attraction that interested Wolfgar. Catti Bree was beyond his experience, a young woman who did not fit the role as it had been defined to him on the tundra. He wasn't sure if he liked this independence or not, but he found himself unable to deny the attraction that he felt for her.
"You come up here often, do you not?" Catti Bree asked. "What is it you look for?"
Wolfgar shrugged, not fully knowing the answer himself.
"Your home?"
"That? And other things that a woman would not understand."
Catti Bree smiled away the unintentional insult.
"Tell me then,"
she pressed, hints of sarcasm edging her tone.
"Maybe my ignorance will bring a new perspective to these problems."
She hopped down the rock to circle the barbarian and take a seat on the ledge beside him. Wolfgar marveled at her graceful movements. Like the polarity of her curious emotional blend, Catti Bree also proved an enigma physically. She was tall and slender, delicate by all appearances, but growing into womanhood in the caverns of the dwarves, she was accustomed to hard and heavy work.
"Of adventures and an unfulfilled vow," Wolfgar said mysteriously,
perhaps to impress the young girl, but more so to reinforce his own opinion about what a woman should and should not care about.
"A vow you mean to fulfill," Catti Bree reasoned, "as soon as you're given the chance."
Wolfgar nodded solemnly.
"It is my heritage, a burden passed on to me when my father was killed. The day will come."
He let his voice trail away, and he looked back longingly to the emptiness of the open tundra beyond Kelvin's cairn. Catti Bree shook her head, the auburn locks bouncing across her shoulders. She saw beyond Wolfgar's mysterious facade enough to understand that he meant to undertake a very dangerous, probably suicidal mission in the name of honor.
"What drives you, I cannot tell. Luck to you on your adventure. But if you're taking it for no better reason than you have named, you're wasting your life."
"What could a woman know of honor?"
Wolfgar shot back angrily. But Catti Bree was not intimidated and did not back down.
"What indeed?"
she echoed.
"Do you think that you hold it all in your oversized hands for no better reason than what you hold in your pants?"
Wolfgar blushed a deep red and turned away, unable to come to terms with such nerve in a woman.
Besides, Caddy Bree continued, you can say what you want about why you have come up here this day. I know that you're worried about Brunner, and I'll hear no denying.
You know only what you desire to know.
You are a lot like him,
Caddy Bree said abruptly, shifting the subject and disregarding Wolfgar's comments.
More akin to the dwarf than you'd ever admit, she laughed. Both stubborn, both proud, and neither about to admit an honest feeling for the other. Have it your own way, then, Wolfgar of Icewind Dale. To me you can lie, but to yourself? That's a different tale.
She hopped from her perch and skipped down the rocks toward the dwarven caverns. Wolfgar watched her go, admiring the sway of her slender hips and the graceful dance of her step, despite the anger that he felt. He didn't stop to think of why he was so mad at Caddy Bree. He knew that if he did, he would find, as usual, that he was angry because her observations hit the mark. Drisdo Erden kept a stoic vigil over his unconscious friend for 2 long days. Worried as he was about Brunner and curious about the wondrous warhammer, the drow remained a respectful distance from the secret forge. Finally, as morning dawned on the 3rd day, Brunner stirred and stretched. Drizzt silently padded away, moving down the path he knew the dwarf would take. Finding an appropriate clearing, he hastily set up a small campsite. The sunlight came to Brunner as only a blur at first, and it took him several minutes to reorient himself to his surroundings. Then his returning vision focused on the shining glory of the warhammer. Quickly he glanced around him, looking for signs of the fallen dust. He found none, and his anticipation heightened. He was trembling once again as he lifted the magnificent weapon, turning it over in his hands, feeling its perfect balance and incredible strength. Brunner's breath flew away when he saw the symbols of the 3 gods on the mithril, diamond dust magically fused into their deeply etched lines. Entranced by the apparent perfection of his work, Brunner understood the emptiness his father had spoken of. He knew that he would never duplicate this level of his craft, and he wondered if, knowing this, he would ever be able to lift his smithy hammer again. Trying to sort through his mixed emotions, the dwarf put the silver mallet and chisel back into their golden coffer and replaced the scroll in its tube, though the parchment was blank and the magical runes would never reappear. He realized that he hadn't eaten in several days, and his strength hadn't fully recovered from the drain of the magic. He collected as many things as he could carry, hoisted the huge warhammer over his shoulder, and trudged off toward his home. The sweet scent of roasting coney greeted him as he came upon Drisdo Erden's camp.
"So, you're back from your travels," he called in greeting to his friend.
Drizzt locked his eyes onto the dwarf's, not wanting to give away his overwhelming curiosity for the warhammer.
"At your request, good dwarf," he said, bowing low. "Surely you had enough people looking for me to expect that I'd return."
Brunner conceded the point, though for the present he only offered absently,
"I needed ye,"
as an explanation. A more pressing need had come over him at the sight of the cooking meat. Drizzt smiled knowingly. He had already eaten and had caught and cooked this coney especially for Brunner.
"Join me?" he asked.
Before he had even finished the offer, Brunner was eagerly reaching for the rabbit. He stopped suddenly, though, and turned a suspicious eye upon the drow.
"How long have you been in?" the dwarf asked nervously.
"Just arrived this morning," Drizzt lied, respecting the privacy of the dwarf's special ceremony.
Brunner smirked at the answer and tore into the coney as Drizzt set another on the spit. The drow waited until Brunner was engrossed with his meal, then quickly snatched up the warhammer. By the time Brunner could react, Drizzt had already lifted the weapon.
"Too big for a dwarf," Drizzt remarked casually, "and too heavy for my slender arms."
He looked at Brunner, who stood with his forearms crossed and his foot stamping impatiently.
"Who then?"
"Ye've a talent for putting your nose in where it don't belong, elf," the dwarf answered gruffly.
Drizzt laughed in response.
"The boy Wolfgar?"
he asked in mock disbelief.
He knew well that the dwarf harbored strong feelings for the young barbarian, though he also realized that Brunner would never openly admit it. A fine weapon to be giving a barbarian. Did you craft it yourself? Despite his chiding, Drizzt was truly awestricken by Brunner's workmanship. Though the hammer was far too heavy for him to wield, he could clearly feel its incredible balance.
"Just an old hammer, that's all," Brunner mumbled. "The boy lost his club. I couldn't well turn him loose in a wild place without a weapon."
"And its name?"
"Aegis Fang," Brunner replied without thinking, the name flowing from him before he even had time to consider it.
He didn't remember the incident, but the dwarf had determined the name of the weapon when he had enchanted it as part of the magical intonations of the ceremony. "I understand," Drizzt said, handing the hammer back to Brunner. "An old hammer, but good enough for the boy. Mithril, adamantite, and diamond will simply have to do."
"Ah, shut your mouth," snapped Brunner. His face flushed red with embarrassment.
Drizzt bowed low in apology. "Why did you request my presence, friend?" the drow asked, changing the subject. Brunner cleared his throat.
"The boy,"
he grumbled softly. Drizzt saw the uncomfortable lump well in Brunner's throat and buried his next taunt before he spoke it.
"He comes free afore winter," continued Brunner. "And he's not rightly trained. Stronger than any man I've ever seen, and moves with the grace of a fleeing deer, but he's green to the ways of battle."
"You want me to train him?" Drizzt asked incredulously.
"Well, I can't do it," Brunner snapped suddenly. "He's 7 foot, and wouldn't be taken well to the low cuts of a dwarf."
The drow eyed his frustrated companion curiously. Like everyone else who was close to Brunner, he knew that a bond had grown between the dwarf and the young barbarian, but he hadn't guessed just how deep it ran.
"I didn't take him under me eye for 5 years, just to let him get cut down by a stinking tundra yeti,"
Brunner blurted, impatient with the drow's hesitance, and nervous that his friend had guessed more than he should.
"Will ye do it, then?"
Drizzt smiled again, but there was no teasing in it this time. He remembered his own battle with tundra yetis nearly 5 years before. Brunner had saved his life that day, and it hadn't been the first and wouldn't be the last time that he had fallen into the dwarf's debt. "The gods know that I owe you more than that, my friend. Of course I'll train him." Brunner grunted and grabbed the next coney. The ring of Wulfgar's pounding echoed through the dwarven halls. Angered by the revelations he had been forced to see in his discussion with Catti Bree, he had returned to his work with fervor.
"Stop your hammering, boy!" came a gruff voice behind him. Wulfgar spun on his heel.
He had been so engrossed in his work that he hadn't heard Brunner enter. An involuntary smile of relief widened across his face, but he caught the show of weakness quickly and repainted a stern mask. Brunner regarded the young barbarian's great height and girth, and the scraggly beginnings of a blonde beard upon the golden skin of his face.
"I can't rightly be calling ye boy anymore," the dwarf conceded.
"You have the right to call me whatever you wish," retorted Wulfgar. "I am your slave."
"Ye've a spirit as wild as the tundra," Brunner said, smiling. "Ye've never been, nor will ye ever be, a slave to any dwarf or man."
Wulfgar was caught off guard by the dwarf's uncharacteristic compliment. He tried to reply, but could find no words.
"Never have I seen ye as a slave, boy," Brunner continued. "Ye served me to pay for the crimes of your people, and I taught ye much in return. Now put your hammer away."
He paused for a moment to consider Wulfgar's fine workmanship.
"You're a good smith, with a good feel for the stone. But ye don't belong in a dwarf's cave. It's time ye felt the sun on your face again."
"Freedom?" Wulfgar whispered.
"Get the notion out of your head," Brunner snapped.
He pointed a stubby finger at the barbarian and growled threateningly.
You're mine till the last days of fall. Don't ye forget that.
Wulfgar had to bite his lip to stem a laugh. As always, the dwarf's awkward combination of compassion and borderline rage had confused him and kept him off balance. It no longer came as a shock, though. 4 years at Brunner's side had taught him to expect and disregard the sudden outbursts of gruffness.
"Finish up whatever ye got to do here," Brunner instructed. "I take ye out to meet your teacher tomorrow morning, and by your vow, you'll heed to him as you would to me."
Wulfgar grimaced at the thought of servitude to yet another, but he had accepted his indenture to Brunner unconditionally for a period of 5 years and a day, and he would not dishonor himself by going back on his oath. He nodded his consent.
"I won't be seeing much more of ye," Brunner continued. "So I'll have your oath now that ye'll never again raise a weapon against the people of Ten Towns."
Wulfgar set himself firmly.
"That you may not have," he replied boldly. "When I have fulfilled the terms you set before me, I shall leave here a man of free will."
"Fair enough," Brunner conceded,
Wulfgar's stubborn pride actually enhancing the dwarf's respect for him. He paused for a moment to look over the proud young warrior and found himself pleased at his own part in Wulfgar's growth.
"Ye broke that stinking pole of yours on me head," Brunner began tentatively.
He cleared his throat. This final order of business made the tough dwarf uncomfortable. He wasn't quite sure of how he could get through it without appearing sentimental and foolish.
"Winter'll be fast upon ye after your term to me has ended. I can't rightly send ye out into the wild without a weapon."
He reached back into the hallway quickly and grabbed the warhammer.
"Aegis Fang," he said gruffly as he tossed it to Wulfgar. "I'll place no bonds on your will, but I'll have your oath for me own good conscience that ye'll never raise this weapon against the people of Ten Towns."
As soon as his hands closed around the adamantite handle, Wulfgar sensed the worth of the magical warhammer. The diamond-filled runes caught the glow of the forge and sent a myriad of reflections dancing about the room. The barbarians of Wulfgar's tribe had always prided themselves on the fine weapons they kept, even measuring the worth of a man by the quality of his spear or sword. But Wulfgar had never seen anything to match the exquisite detail and sheer strength of Aegis Fang. It balanced so well in his huge hands, and its height and weight fit him so perfectly, that he felt as if he had been born to wield this weapon. He told himself at once that he would pray for many nights to the gods of fate for delivering this prize unto him. Certainly they deserved his thanks. As did Brunner.
"You have my word,"
Wulfgar stammered, so overcome by the magnificent gift that he could hardly speak. He steadied himself so that he could say more, but by the time he was able to pull his gaze from the magnificent hammer, Brunner was gone. The dwarf stomped through the long corridors toward his private chambers, mumbling curses at his weakness and hoping that none of his kin came upon him. With a cautious look around, he wiped the moisture from his gray eyes. 13. As the Wielder Bids.
"Gather together your people and go, Bigrin," the wizard told the enormous frost giant that stood before him in Kryshal Tiras' throne room. "Remember that you represent the army of Akkar Kessel. You are the first group to go into the area, and secrecy is the key to our victory. Do not fail me. I shall be watching over your every move."
"We'll not fail ye, master," the giant responded. "The lair'll be set and readied for your coming."
"I have faith in you," Kessel assured the huge commander. "Now be off."
The frost giant lifted the blanketed mirror that Kessel had given it, gave one final bow to its master, and walked out of the room.
"You should not have sent them," hissed Ertu,
who had been standing invisibly beside the throne during the conversation.
The Verbeeg and their frost giant leader will be easy to mark in a community of humans and dwarves.
Bigrin is a wise leader, Kessel shot back, angered at the demon's impertinence. The giant is cunning enough to keep troops out of sight.
Yet the humans would have been better suited for this mission, as Crenshinabon has shown you.
I am the leader, screamed Kessel. He pulled the crystal shard out from under his robes and waved it menacingly at Ertu, leaning forward in an attempt to emphasize the threat. Crenshinabon advises, but I decide. Do not forget your place, mighty demon. I am the wielder of the shard, and I shall not tolerate your questioning my every move.
Ertu's blood-red eyes narrowed dangerously, and Kessel straightened back in his throne, suddenly reconsidering the wisdom of threatening the demon. But Ertu calmed quickly, accepting the minor inconveniences of Kessel's foolish outbursts for the long-term gains it stood to make.
Crenshinabon has existed since the dawn of the world, the demon rasped, making one final point. It has orchestrated 1,000 campaigns much grander than the one you are about to undertake. Perhaps you would be wise to give more credence to its advice.
Kessel twitched nervously. The shard had indeed counseled him to use the humans he would soon command in the first excursion into the region. He had been able to create 12 excuses to validate his choice of sending the giants, but in truth, he had sent Bigrin's people more to illustrate his undeniable command to himself, to the shard, and to the impertinent demon, than for any possible military gains.
I shall follow Crenshinabon's advice when I deem it appropriate, he told Ertu.
He pulled a second crystal, an exact duplicate of Crenshinabon and the crystal he had used to raise this tower, out from one of the many pockets of his robe.
Take this to the appropriate spot and perform the ceremony of raising, he instructed. I shall join you through a mirror door when all is ready.
You wish to raise a second Kreischel Tirith while the first still stands?
Ertu balked.
The drain on the relic shall be enormous.
Silence!
Kessel ordered, trembling visibly.
Go and perform the ceremony. Let the shard remain my concern.
Ertu took the replica of the relic and bowed low. Without a further word, the demon stalked out of the room. It understood that Kessel was foolishly demonstrating his control over the shard at the expense of proper restraint and wise military tactics. The wizard did not have the capacity or the experience to orchestrate this campaign, yet the shard continued to back him. Ertu had made a secret offer to it to dispose of Kessel and take over as wielder, but Crenshinabon had refused the demon. It preferred the demonstrations that Kessel demanded of it to appease his own insecurities over the constant struggle of control it would face against the powerful demon. Though he walked among giants and trolls, the proud barbarian king's stature was not diminished. He strode defiantly through the iron door of the Black Tower and pushed through the wretched troll guards with a threatening growl. He hated this place of sorcery, and had decided to ignore the calling, when the singular spinet of the tower appeared on the horizon like an icy finger risen from the flat ground. Yet in the end, he could not resist the summons of the master of Kreischel Tirith. Hefstag hated the wizard. By all measures of a tribesman, Akar Kessel was weak, using tricks and demonic callings to do the work of muscle. And Hefstag hated him even more because he could not refute the power that the wizard commanded. The barbarian king threw aside the dangling beaded strands that sectioned off Akar Kessel's private audience hall on the tower's second level. The wizard reclined on a huge satin pillow in the middle of the room, his long painted fingernails tapping impatiently on the floor. Several nude slave girls, their minds bent and broken under the shard's domination, waited on every whim of the shard's wielder. It angered Hefstag to see women enslaved to such a puny, pitiful shell of a man. He considered,
and not for the first time, a sudden charge, burying his great axe deep into the wizard's skull. But the room was filled with strategically located screens and pillars, and the barbarian knew, even if he refused to believe that the wizard's will could deny his rage, that Kessel's pet demon wouldn't be far from its master.
"So good that you could join me, noble Hiefstag," said Kessel, in a calm, disarming way.
Ertu and Kryn Shinnabon were close at hand. He felt quite secure, even in the presence of the rugged barbarian king. He fondled one of the slaves absently, showing off his absolute rule.
"Really, you should have come sooner. Already many of my forces are assembled. The first group of scouts has already departed."
He leaned forward toward the barbarian to emphasize his point.
"If I can find no room for your people in my plans," he said with an evil snicker, "then I shall have no need for your people at all."
Hiefstag didn't flinch or change his expression in the least.
"Come now, mighty king," the wizard crooned. "Sit and share in the riches of my table."
Hiefstag clung to his pride and remained unmoving.
"Very well,"
snapped Kessel. He clenched his fist and uttered a command word.
"To whom do you owe your fealty?"
he demanded. Hiefstag's body went rigid.
"To Akkar Kessel,"
he responded, to his own repulsion.
"And tell me again, who is it that commands the tribes of the tundra?"
"They follow me," Hiefstag replied, "and I follow Akkar Kessel. Akkar Kessel commands the tribes of the tundra."
The wizard released his fist, and the barbarian king slumped back.
"I take little joy in doing that to you,"
said Kessel, rubbing a burr in one of his painted nails.
"Do not make me do it again."
He pulled a scroll out from behind the satin pillow and tossed it to the floor.
"Sit before me," he instructed Hiefstag. "Tell me again of your defeat."
Hiefstag took his place on the floor in front of his master and unrolled the parchment. It was a map of 10 towns. 14. Lavender Eyes. Brunner had regained his dour visage by the time he called on Wulfgar the following morning. Still, it touched the dwarf deeply, though he was able to hide the fact, to see Aegis Fang casually slung over the young barbarian's shoulder, as if it had always been there, and always belonged there. Wulfgar, too, was wearing a sullen mask. He passed it off as anger at being put into the service of another,